You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville, and this is the Asheville FM News Hour. I'm News Director Patricia Furnish. The Asheville FM News Hour theme music is composed by local artist Alusha Tistas. Views and opinions expressed on the Asheville FM News Hour do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM. For questions, feedback, story suggestions, and more, please email us at news@ashevillefm.org. For these stories and more, find us on Facebook at Asheville FM. Tonight on the Asheville FM News Hour, we have the Civic Roundup with reporter Mark West, the Healthy Asheville Report from Dr. Dick Needleman, and we have an arts and entertainment spotlight from contributor Julia Haverstock. She spoke with writer and collaborator from the Monford neighborhood area, Amy Worthen, about her collaborative work to raise awareness about social issues and to support projects led by people of color. And now here's Michelle Sheave with tonight's headlines.
In local news, early voting turnout in Western North Carolina's congressional district is among the highest in the state, despite the 11th district race between Democrat Jasmine Beach Ferrara and Republican Chuck Edwards, predicted to be less competitive than other U.S. House contests. Through November 3rd, a total of 28.6% of registered voters in the 11th district's 15 counties had ballots accepted through mail-in and early in-person voting, according to state data presented by the Asheville Citizen-Times. That was second only to 28.8% in the 4th district, which included Durham and features a race between Democrat Valerie Fushi and Republican Courtney Giles. Like the 11th district, that contest has no incumbent. At first, reports had shown early voting numbers lagging statewide, but that had changed as of November 4th, with mail-in and early in-person voting surpassing the same time in 2018, the last midterm election, state officials said. Community Reparations Commission Chair Dwight Mullen says the group is a step closer to making its first set of recommendations. The group met Monday night in downtown Asheville. Its goal is to come up with how reparations will look in Asheville and Buncombe County. Such steps may include vouchers for housing or investing in a few neighborhoods. Mullen says he's hearing passionate voices about immediate, short, and long-term goals, with some expressing and impatience for the commission to get going and to increase the speed of its work. The group hopes to send a list of immediate recommendations to the city and county after its next meeting, which is scheduled for 6 p.m. December 5th. Asheville made national headlines when, on July 14, 2020, the City Council pledged to fund a controversial reparations initiative for African American residents and neighborhoods. 2 years later, with $365,583 spent for a consultant hired by the City of Asheville to help guide the 25-member Community Reparations Commission, discussions and considerations of how to spend the reserve funds totaling more than $4 million is still underway. Mullen says that he realizes that the commission has taken a long time to make decisions regarding the allocations of funding, but says that there are no precedents for the commission to follow. He says that he would like the Asheville Community Reparations Commission to serve as a model for other cities to follow in the future. The Buncombe County Sheriff's Office alleges that the Irwin Youth League's longtime treasurer illegally benefited from her position, but her lawyer is questioning the legitimacy of those charges. The Asheville Citizen-Times reported that the agency charged Sarah Denise Parton, 41, with embezzlement and 5 counts of obtaining property by false pretense, according to arrest warrants. All those charges are felonies. She was arrested November 4th 4th and released from jail later that day on a written promise to appear in court. The sheriff's office launched an investigation in August after a more recent treasurer for the league reported possible embezzlement, and the agency noted inconsistencies between bank accounts and statements, according to a search warrant returned to the magistrate's office in November. The Irwin Youth League is a volunteer-run organization that teaches children sports fundamentals. Hardin volunteered as a treasurer for 9 years. In state news, North Carolina Democrats are positioned to boost their party's representation in the U.S. House, but the gains under a newly enacted voting map could be short-lived, according to reporting from Raleigh television station WRAL. A pair of races in and outside the Triangle are among the nation's most competitive and divisive, and they'll play a role in determining whether Democrats maintain their slim majority in the House. Democrats currently control 5 of the state's 13 seats. After data from the U.S. Census Bureau gave North Carolina an additional seat, the Republican-controlled legislature last year passed a redistricting plan that could have given the GOP up to 11 of the 14 seats. The proposed map was struck down by the state Supreme Court, which held that the map was drawn for pure partisan gain in a way that violated the state constitution. Lawmakers were ordered to go back to the drawing board and get a new map approved by a lower court. After the redraw was rejected, North Carolina judges appointed independent redistricting experts to draft congressional lines. The map ultimately enacted is to be used only for this year's election. Across the nation, housing markets are shifting, and through the Triangle real estate market remains one where demand for homes remain elevated due to continued job creation and in-migration in the region. The latest data shows that the market may be returning to equilibrium following more than 2 years of rapid price inflation. Across the Triangle, the median sale price of property listed on the Triangle Multiple Listing Service that closed in October 22 was $392,000. The preliminary data shows that's the lowest median sale price recorded in any month since February 2022, and a drop of nearly $30,000 in sale price from the prior high of $421,757 recorded in June 2022. Similarly, new data from the RE/MAX National Housing Report for August 2022 showed in Charlotte home sales are down 20% and there's a lot more inventory. Across the state, median house prices have increased, meaning that the houses on the market have tended toward the more expensive. In Charlotte, in August, the median home price was $332,000. Now it's $388,000, representing a 16% increase in just a year. Sales of houses with 5 or more bedrooms have increased 19% in Charlotte, contrasted with homes with just 1 bedroom, which have increased only 9%. A motorcycle crash on the notorious stretch of a road known only as the Dragon ignited a wildfire that has spread across 100 acres inside Great Smoky Mountains National Park, according to Tennessee officials. The fire was 90% contained Monday, November 9th, and some ongoing rain is likely to help tremendously, the Tennessee State Highway Patrol reported on Twitter. All lanes of U.S. I-29 are closed between Deals Gap, North Carolina, and Tabcat Boat Launch area in Tennessee, officials said. The two-lane stretch of highway is known as the Dragon and Tail of the Dragon and has a reputation for being one of the most exciting and dangerous roads to drive on in the country. The wildfire first reported around 11:30 a.m. Sunday, November 6, about 2 miles west of Parson Branch Road near Chilliwe Lake, National Park Service officials said in a news release. The motorcycle lost control and collided into the roadside. Upon collision, the motorcycle was engulfed in flames, which ignited the wildfire, park officials said. The motorcycle vehicle operator was able to safely exit the accident site before the fire erupted. Much of the fire had been extinguished late Monday, but one area continued to smolder, officials said. The fire was located near Cattail Branch in the backcountry and is not near any hiking trails, the park said. The Dragon is considered a thrill ride for motorcycle and sports cars and enthusiasts. It gets its name from its curves like a dragon tail, according to reporting in the Raleigh News and Observer. In national and international news, Russian troops have denounced what they called an incomprehensible battle in Donetsk after apparently sustaining heavy losses during a week of intense fighting in the key eastern region of Ukraine, according to CNN. Moscow has been trying to break through Kiev's defenses around the town of Pavlivka for at least the past 7 days, but it seems to have made little progress with as many as 300 men killed in action. According to an open letter published on a prominent Russian military blog on Monday, the men of the 155th Brigade of the Russian Pacific Fleet Marines launched stinging criticism against a senior Russian official in a rare display of defiance, according to authorities, of hiding the number of casualties for fear of being held accountable. The letter, purportedly sent from the front lines to a regional Russian governor, came amid Moscow's shaky offensive in the region President Vladimir Putin claimed to have illegally annexed just over a month ago. The letter accused a Russian general of sending men into battle in order to gain bonuses and advance, which the letter said resulted in the loss of 300 men, 50% of the brigade's equipment, and the falsification of casualty statistics by the general for fear of being held accountable. New Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson issued her first Supreme Court opinion Monday, according to the Associated Press. Jackson's first opinion was a short dissent in support of a death row inmate from Ohio. Jackson wrote that she could have thrown out lower court rulings in the case of Ohio inmate David Chin, whose lawyers argued that the state suppressed evidence that might have altered the outcome of his trial. The two-page opinion came on the same day the high court was hearing cases that are part of a wider dispute over the power of federal government. In her dissent, Jackson wrote that she would have ordered a new look at Chin's case because his life is on the line and given the substantial likelihood that the suppressed records would have changed the outcome at trial. The evidence at issue indicated that a key witness against Chin had an intellectual disability that might have affected his memory and his ability to testify accurately, she wrote. The impacts of climate change threaten the things Americans value most, according to the latest version of the Federal Interagency National Climate Assessment. The NCA, the first since 2018, warns that the safety of homes and communities are at risk due to climate change. The report adds that many of those extreme impacts are already reality and poised to worsen in parts of the country. For example, parts of the country have seen intensified rainfall and flooding in regions like the Northeast and Midwest, according to the NCA. These phenomena have consequences beyond immediate damage, the report notes. They could also result in runoff that damages crops and water supplies. For example, between 1981 and 2016, excessive precipitation cost the U.S. about as much in maize crop yield as extreme drought would have. Droughts, meanwhile, have caused nearly $300 billion in damages over the last four decades, and their impact is likely to intensify in the future, particularly in the Southwest, which has already seen a drought lasting most of this century.
This is the Civic Roundup for November 9th, 2022, with Mark West reporting election results. Our summary results are as follows. Esther Mannheimer was re-elected as Asheville's mayor, and the two Buncombe County bonds issues passed with significant margins. Maggie Almond-Bethayum will join Asheville City Council, and Martin Moore, as well as two incumbents, won commissioner seats, with Robert Presley defeated. Quentin Miller won another term as sheriff. Overall voter turnout in Buncombe County was higher than in the 2018 midterms. In statewide elections, Republicans won both the NC Senate and U.S. House District 11 races. While nationally, control of the Senate and House are still in question, as vote counting continues in key elections nationwide, and one important Senate election in Georgia seems destined to head to a runoff. In state elections, Ted Budd, Republican, won election as senator from North Carolina with almost 51% of the vote, with Sherry Beasley, Democrat, close behind at 47%. The U.S. House seat for District 11 was won by Chuck Edwards, Republican, who received 54% of the votes cast. Jasmine Beach Ferrara, Democrat, trailed at 44%. In other state elections, Lucy Inman and Sam Irvin IV both lost to their Republican opponents for the Supreme Court Associate Justice seats 3 and 5, respectively, each receiving 48% of votes cast compared to their opponents' 53%. Their opponents were Richard Dietz and Trey Allen. Similarly, the two NC Court of Appeals judge seats which were open went to Republicans. Julie Tate Flood won seat 8 on the appeals court with 53% of votes cast over Carolyn Jennings Thompson, the Democrat, who received 40% of the vote. Donna Stroud, Republican, won seat 9 on the appeals court with 55% of votes cast over Brad A. Salmon, the Democrat, who received 45% of the vote. These statewide races paint a picture of a North Carolina trending slightly towards the Republican Party. In 2020, Trump received 50.1% of votes cast in the presidential election, compared with 48.7% of votes cast going to Biden. Local elections, however, seem to favor Democratic candidates. In the NC House of Representatives District 115 race, the winner, Leslie Prather, Democrat, received 57% of votes cast, contrasting with Prathik Ochta, Republican, who received 43%. Julie Mayfield, Democrat, won the North Carolina State Senate District 49 race over John Anderson, Republican, with 66% of votes cast, to Anderson's 35%. In the Buncombe County Board of Commissioners race, Al Whiteside, Democrat, won District 1 with 67% of votes cast, while Martin Moore, Democrat, won District 2 with 55% of votes. District 3 was won by Amanda Edwards, Democrat, with 63% of votes cast, and Quentin Miller, Democrat, was reelected with 60% of votes as sheriff. In the nonpartisan Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor election, Sarah Nichols at 44% and Anthony D. Cole at 34% were the top two vote-getters. The winner of the Board of Education election for Inca District was Judy S. Lewis. For Irwin, the winner was Kim Plemons, and for Reynolds, the winner was Rob Elliott. The mayoral election for the city of Asheville was won by Esther Mannheimer, who received 54% of the vote, contrasted with 45% of the votes going to her opponent, Kim Roney. Maggie Almond-Bethayum, who received 21% of votes, will be a new face on city council, while Antoinette Mosley with 20% and Shanika Smith at 18% will return to council. Elected to Asheville City School Board were Amy Ray, Zara Thornburg, Rebecca Strimmer, and Liza English Kelly. And both the Buncombe County Open Space Bonds Referendum and the Buncombe County Housing Bonds Referendum passed by wide margins. The yes vote for the open space bond was 69%, and the yes vote on the housing bond was 62%. In commentary, it may be that the biggest loser in the 2022 midterms was Donald Trump. In the 22 midterm elections from 1934 to 2018, the president's party has averaged a loss of 28 House seats and 4 Senate seats. The president's party gained seats in the House only 3 times, but gained seat in the Senate on 6 occasions. The president's party has gained seats in both houses only twice. As the American Presidency Project at UC Santa Barbara says, partisan seat swings in midterms elections are consistently correlated with 2 factors. They are the level of public approval of the incumbent president and the number of seats of each House of Congress up for election controlled by the president's party. As the approval of the president falls, the greater the number of seats lost by the president's party. In this sense, the midterm is taken as a referendum on the incumbent president. And, as the number of seats to defend increases, the greater the number of seats lost tends to be. 14 seats held by Democrats and 21 seats held by Republicans were up for election in this election cycle. And, presidents' approval ratings have been in the low 40% range for most of 2022. These factors led the Gallup polling organization in June to conclude that the current Democratic congressional majority is facing an extremely unfavorable election environment. The party of the president typically loses U.S. House seats in midterm elections, an average of 23 since 1974. However, 2022 may not be an average year. Rather, as of May, Gallup finds presidential job approval and 3 other key national mood indicators to be well below historical averages measured in past midterm election years. On their own, these numbers would all predict a greater than average loss of seats for the Democratic Party this fall. And we might remember that Democrats lost 63 House seats in Barack Obama's first midterm and 52 in Bill Clinton's. But last night's election data differed significantly from these predictions. Donald Trump, with a popularity rating 7 percentage points lower than Biden's, played a role in selecting candidates in several important states, including Pennsylvania and Georgia. That there isn't a final projection for the House suggests it was a fairly good night for Democrats, considering the odds they faced. Despite the headwinds against them, Democrats won some seats that typically go for the party in the GOP's position in the midterm, like competitive open seats, North Carolina's 13th district and Ohio's 13th district, and a purple seat held by a GOP incumbent in Ohio. Pivotally, Democrats held on to some highly competitive seats that might have fallen had the Republicans' position been stronger. The Republicans still are likely to gain a majority situation in the House and perhaps the Senate. The Democrats had some real disappointments, including the defeat of Sherry Beasley here in North Carolina. And the Florida Republicans had a very good night last night, particularly in the House, where they picked up a number of seats, suggesting that Ron DeSantis is making real inroads with the Hispanic population in Florida. Another item that appears to have been on the ballot was anti-Semitism, which seemed to lose. Josh Shapiro was elected Pennsylvania governor in his run against Republican Doug Mastriano, a Christian nationalist who embraced anti-Semitic tropes with particular vigor. Pundits expect Shapiro to be an influential voice in the Democratic Party in coming years and are already talking about him as a viable future presidential candidate. That's because he's from a large swing state, crucial in every battle for the White House. Plus, he has a polished campaigning style, moderate views, a lack of political baggage, and strong support from union workers. In more local politics, Asheville is a Democratic bubble. Data for West Asheville, where Asheville FM is located, suggests that only 9% of the station's neighbors are Republican. That is reflected in local elections, where Republicans often don't even bother to run for office. what some political scientists have called the Great Sort, a long-term social movement in which more liberal voters move to blue enclaves, leaving the countryside open to conservative voters, seems to be at play here. Asheville and Buncombe County are blue and seem to be getting bluer. This long-term shift seems to have doomed the candidacy of Robert Presley. But what we may eventually see as the big takeaway of the 2022 midterms is that abortion rights won in a number of states. In Republican-leaning Kentucky, an anti-abortion amendment was defeated, clearing a potential path for abortion access to be restored in a state with one of the country's most restrictive bans. In Michigan, Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer was reelected in part by presenting herself as a champion of abortion rights. And voters approved a ballot initiative that will enshrine the right to abortion in the state constitution, preventing a 1931 abortion ban from taking effect. The California Constitution will protect the right to an abortion after residents on Tuesday passed a ballot initiative to enshrine the right in the state's governing document. Voters in Vermont on Tuesday approved an amendment to the state's constitution that abortion rights supporters say will protect every person's right to make their own reproductive decisions. And here in North Carolina, Republicans failed to win a veto-proof legislative supermajority, ensuring that Democratic Governor Roy Cooper will continue to have the power to block abortion restrictions in a state that has become a critical access point for people seeking abortions across the Southeast. This has been the Civic Roundup for November 5th, 2022, Mark West reporting. Our theme music is by SP.
Now here's Dr. Dick Needleman with tonight's Healthy Asheville Report.
Hi, I am Dr. Dick Needleman, health reporter for 103.3 Asheville FM, with this week's Healthy Asheville Health Report. In local news, here is this week's Buncombe County COVID-19 Community Update. The CDC reports that the community level for Buncombe County is low for the week ending October 31st. Most of the counties in North Carolina are low, and no counties are at a high level. Most of the counties in the U.S. are at a low level, with less than 3% of the counties at a high level. For a community at a low community level, the CDC recommends you may choose to wear a mask at any time as an additional precaution to protect yourself and others. If you are at high risk for severe illness, consider wearing a mask indoors in public and take additional precautions. The Buncombe County COVID-19 metrics are on the North Carolina COVID dashboard. Data from the week ending on October 29th indicate there have been 91 cases per 100,000 residents in the last 7 days, up 21% from 75 the previous week. 67% of the total population have received their primary vaccination series, unchanged over the past 12 weeks. 21% of people with their primary vaccination series have had the new bivalent booster, up from 18% from the last week. The 7-day daily average of COVID-19 hospitalizations is 41 and has decreased by 2 since last week. And of ICU patients is 5 and has decreased by 1 from the previous week. The Department of Health and Human Services recommends stay up to date with COVID-19 vaccines and boosters. People with any COVID symptoms should get tested. People who are positive for COVID-19 or do not feel well should stay home. Vaccination sites and testing sites can be located through the North Carolina and Buncombe County Department of Health and Human Services. An updated COVID-19 booster is now available for eligible persons 5 years and older. This new booster targets two versions of the COVID-19 virus, the original virus and the new dominant BA4 and BA5 variants. It will replace the previous booster shot that had targeted only the original version of the virus. Eligible persons must be at least 2 months after any prior COVID-19 shots and have had the primary vaccination series. The CDC advises that people who recently had COVID consider delaying their boosters until 3 months after their symptoms started, or after a positive COVID test if they were asymptomatic. Booster shots are available at the Department of Public Health Cox Avenue Vaccination Clinic, pharmacies, community health centers, and rural health clinics. In state news, on October 11th, Governor Cooper signed an agreement to provide funding to purchase food from North Carolina's underserved farmers and producers, and to distribute it to local communities and schools. The agreement was between the U.S. Department of Agriculture, also known as the USDA, and the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. USDA Deputy Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Mei Wu, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, and North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services Chief Deputy Commissioner David Smith announced the agreement in Durham, North Carolina. Deputy Undersecretary Wu said that, quote, USDA is excited to partner with North Carolina to promote economic opportunities for farmers and producers and to increase access to locally sourced, fresh, healthy, and nutritious food in underserved communities and in schools, unquote. The federal government will allocate over $5.6 million for schools to purchase food from disadvantaged farmers and ranchers for the benefits of students and communities. Serving local foods in North Carolina schools will further support the state's farm-to-school program. This will help North Carolina schools improve child nutrition through the National School Lunch and School Breakfast programs. Funding for the agreement comes from the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, also known as the COVID-19 Stimulation Package, and from the Commodity Credit Corporation, a U.S. government corporation that was created in 1933 to support farm income and prices. Governor Roy Cooper said that, quote, it's great to see this collaboration between state and federal government connecting farmers with schools to get students the healthy meals they need. In national news, daylight savings time, also known as DST, can stress our bodies for weeks by upsetting our natural biologic clock that is affected by light and darkness. Health groups have pointed out that fatigue and health problems can occur from sleep loss after the spring forward time change. There are more hospital admissions due to heart attacks, strokes, and irregular heartbeat. Other health problems are more car accidents, including more fatalities, mood swings, and seasonal depression. Christopher Barnes, a sleep researcher, told Mattress Clarity, an organization that reviews sleep products and promotes health sleep, quote, we've discovered that people have about 40 minutes less sleep. Because we're already short on sleep to begin with, the effects of even 40 minutes are noticeable, unquote. As a result of the longer daylight hours during the summer months, beginning in 1966, Congress moved the clocks forward by 1 hour so we can wake up in the morning when the sun rises and have an extra hour of daylight for outdoor leisure activities after the traditional workday. Most countries in North America and Europe have adopted DST during the summer months. Sunday morning, November 6th at 2 a.m. is the time to fall back by setting the clocks back 1 hour and return to standard time. DST will start up on Sunday, March 12th, 2023, and spring forward by advancing our clocks 1 hour. This is the biannual ritual of the changing of the clocks. According to a recent 2022 poll by YouGov, more than two-thirds of Americans want to stop changing the clocks. A recent study in the journal Current Biology reported that eliminating time changes with year-round DST could prevent 33 human deaths, over 2,000 human injuries, and save over $1 billion in collision costs each year. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill last March to make DST permanent throughout the United States. The bill hasn't been voted on by the House. 19 states have already enacted legislation or passed resolutions for year-round DST. However, federal law prohibits states from adopting year-round DST unless it is approved by Congress. Therefore, states can move to year-round standard time. Hawaii, Arizona, and the U.S. territories have year-round standard time. Sleep experts feel that having standard time year-round would be much better for a person's health than year-round DST. Changing the clocks doesn't change the amount of sunlight during the day. However, adopting permanent standard time allows for sunlight to be present at the right time of the day, and the sun would be at its highest point in the sky at 12 noon. In contrast, a shift to permanent DST would also wreak havoc on our natural biologic clock in the winter, as it does in the summer. The sun wouldn't rise until after many people were awake and at work or school, so people would be at higher risk for seasonal depression and car accidents. This has been Dr. Dick Needleman with the Healthy Asheville Health Report. Let's keep Asheville healthy. For questions, feedback, comments, and more, please email me at healthyasheville@ashevillefm.org. Today's health report is posted on our website at www.ashevillefm.org.
That was Dr. Dick Needleman with tonight's Healthy Asheville Report. Now here's tonight's Arts and Entertainment Spotlight from contributor Julia Haverstock.
Will you introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Amy Worthen, and I am a writer, a collaborator, and a musician. I've lived in Western North Carolina since I was a little girl, and I've been in Asheville since the early 1990s. And I moved into the Montford neighborhood in 1998. And professionally, I've worked with a lot of projects over the years, and I always strive to stay oriented towards collective liberation. And I've been writing and publishing essays on topics related to that aspiration on my website, amyworthen.com, for almost 10 years now, which is kind of hard to believe. But if I'm anything, I'm tenacious. So
I have followed you for a while, and I want to know specifically what, if you could tell folks what your goals and motivations are behind doing this research and doing this writing specifically about the Stumptown neighborhood.
I've, you know, loved writing since I was little, since I was writing stories on notebook, wide ruled notebook paper with a pencil when I was little. And it's just always been a part of who I am. Over time, just different life circumstances, relationships, particularly informing my perspectives on the world, motivated me to want to create work that I hope contributes to collective narratives that challenge the status quo. Professionally, that has meant writing everything from website copy to grants to help bring resources to initiatives led by people of color or other system impacted people. And then personally, I'm motivated to share my reflections on systems and solutions and inviting other people to join me on that journey. Like I write to process, and then I want to invite other people to process with me, because it's they're collective questions. And so I want to create narratives that invite questioning. You know, I'm just interested in people's stories. And so a lot of times when I hear someone's story, it makes me want to learn more about, you know, an event or a time period, and then to write about what I learned. As I mentioned, I've lived in Montford for a long time, but just I think in the past few years, I have gotten just more interested in coming to a greater understanding of the gentrification that has happened in my neighborhood, and then my role in that gentrification. And then with the goal of finding possible steps towards repair. I believe in, like, I've been very inspired by Adrienne Marie Brown and her concept of fractals. And so the idea of looking at something small as a reflection of something larger. So I think that the history and the stories of Montford and Stumptown are on one hand very small, localized stories, but they also reflect global themes and global trends, being able to physically engage with neighbors around stories and just physically with the place that I'm writing about is the groove I'm on right now, I guess.
Can you tell us about your most recent blog post and the research that you specifically did for that?
Most recently, I wrote a piece that's called Shakespeare in Stumptown. And it's specifically about some of the history of the area around what you would call the Montford Recreation Complex. And I started the piece just reminding readers of the concept of multiple truths, because it is very possible, and in fact happens all the time, that more than one thing is true at the same time. And I think a lot of times our society wants to simplify things and make it good or bad, or you know, right or wrong. And it's usually things are a lot more complex than that. I was particularly looking at the part of the Montford Recreation Complex, which is the Hazel Robinson Amphitheater that the Montford Park Players use. That amphitheater was kind of the like community green space of a neighborhood called Stumptown, which was historically Black neighborhood, were really founded around the late 1800s. As I mentioned, I love stories, and I had the pleasure to talk to someone who grew up there, Mr. David Jones Jr., who was born in 1935. Before I go further into talking about my piece, I'd love to bring his voice onto the air.
A little bit about the neighborhood. When I say it was home, it was in the middle of this historic Montford district, but set off to itself as an independent little town called Stumptown. And out of Stumptown came some of the world's right now most renowned leaders. Everybody did well that came out of Stumptown. Everybody.
But if you could sum up, and I know that's really hard, but sum up in one word to describe the essence of Stumptown, what would it be?
It had to be two words, or a magical place, a safe place, a place where you were secure, and everybody loved you. Everybody loved you. And you loved everybody.
Mr. Jones paints a picture of a very vibrant place that was very beloved by people. It also, as I did my research, it also was experienced systemic disinvestment, because like most Black neighborhoods across the country, it was redlined. I read that the Stumptown didn't even get water. They were like one of the last places in the city to get connected to the city water, even as the neighboring historic Montford neighborhood, which was built in 1892, they had water and I think even all the amenities like as soon as they were built. Meanwhile, the neighboring Black neighborhood, which was really just on the other side of the road of, you know, that there was like a, you know, one of the like Pearson Drive kind of divided the two neighborhoods. So I learned about Stumptown, and they're still neighbors. There's one of my neighbors who lives in Stumptown. He's lived there like 70 years. But most of that neighborhood was taken during urban renewal for the Montford Recreation Complex. I want to bring in another voice. Kimberly Collins she's from Asheville, and she's a member of the board of the Asheville-Buncombe Community Land Trust. And I meant to mention with the David Jones quote and then with Kimberly's quotes, these are clips from the Montford and Stumptown Stories video series that I've been working on with Asheville FM's own Elizabeth Lachey Garland of Slay the Mic and her team with Major Moments to do this video series. So this is a quote from Kimberly Collins.
That's what urban renewal did. Instead of coming in and renewing the urbanness, they stole the urbanness and gave us what they wanted us to have, so that they could what? Claim the land. And that is probably one of the detrimental things that happened to this area in particular, from the building of 240 to taking the houses that were behind Randolph Elementary School, the Gudger Street, Gudger Alley, going into Stumptown, all down there. That land was taken from all those individuals. And they were told that now this is where you're going to go stay. Because face it, because of racism, we couldn't get along. Even if they were prosperous, you know, teachers or the railroad workers or had just great jobs, what bank was going to give them a loan so they could build another house or to even fix the house? It was all by design, right? Yeah, it's all by design.
As she ends her quote with the idea of it being all about design. So I was looking into this history of the amphitheater itself and learned that when the houses in Stumptown were taken, you know, by eminent domain by the city for this recreation complex, the Parks and Rec director at the time had developed a really close relationship with Hazel Robinson, the founder of the Montford Park Players. And, you know, as I, you know, when we're thinking about multiple truths, the Montford Park Players have really contributed to the cultural landscape of Asheville. And, you know, free theater in the park is a beautiful concept, and I'm all for it. And I did, you know, I learned that they, you know, that this Ray Kasaya, this particular Parks and Rec director, who was a fan of theirs, a friend of theirs, used HUD, Housing and Urban Development money that was designated for other projects in the neighborhood to build this amphitheater for the Montford Park Players. And they have since had access to that for $1 a year, like 40 years. And then these big concerts came in, and they were commercial concerts. So a white private company was making a profit on this, you know, technically community-owned, city-owned resource, on land that was really stolen from a Black community. I had to pull apart all the pieces with the hopes of opening up the conversation to new possibilities. Now that we're, you know, I feel like more people are realizing the ways that systemic oppression has prevented access to power and resources. And then here's an example of a white-led, predominantly white, serving, though not exclusively, and definitely they have had diversity with actors and all that. And I'm, once again, multiple truths, I celebrate that. And I also am questioning, you know, what if a Black performing arts group, someone had built them a theater, an amphitheater that they had for free for 40 years? Like, what would the cultural landscape of Asheville look like now if that had happened? Like I said, it's very complex. There's a lot of pieces to it, but it is one about who has access to resources. All of my different writing and research that I've been doing about Montford is in part sort of dissecting how the gentrification happened.
Can you speak a little more specifically to how the Montford Park Players did or did not include the folks from the neighborhood, or what the neighborhood's reaction was to the theater?
Well, you know, on one hand, you know, they came into a neighborhood that had become blighted by neglect and was basically mostly torn down. I think 80 families lost their homes in the process of clearing out that space for the Montford Recreation Complex. They brought their name with them, which, you know, of course, because they had started Montford Park up in the northern part of the neighborhood. But I think even with the naming of the Montford Recreation Complex, people that I know that grew up in Stumptown really feel the impact of that erasure of even the name of where what was there. And when the Montford Park Players started, which was in the early 80s when the amphitheater was open, I think 1984. The area of Montford where the amphitheater is was 75% Black. I think that that's one of the pieces of the dominant narrative that's been lost, is that the neighborhood Montford in recent decades was majority Black. And, you know, I have friends that grew up there in the 80s that say that they just really didn't feel welcome. You know, Shakespeare is for a certain, you know, it's not for everybody. And if you weren't into Shakespeare, then that was, you know, fundamentally what was happening in the amphitheater. So there wasn't, you know, other, it just, I don't know if the Park Players, if involving the neighborhood was a primary goal or not. I wasn't there, you know, and there's, and like I said, I'm just doing research to try and figure stuff out. And I'm really open to finding out more, but folks that I've spoken with, you know, I mean, I do think Shakespeare appeals to a certain demographic. And I think living here in the neighborhood since, you know, the late 90s, that's what I observe in the audiences. And so I don't know what they've done to, yeah, I mean, that's what I know.
Awesome. Thanks for that, those specifics. I'm wondering if there are other folks that you want to point us towards. Who should we be paying attention to as voices of the neighborhood, and as maybe collectively we try to right the wrongs, repair the harm?
One thing I've really learned and loved from this work that this research I've been doing, and you know, I'm part of an initiative in my neighborhood called the Montford and Stumptown Fund, which is a fund to create and protect permanently affordable housing for Black families as one of those solutions. But in the process of getting to the point of developing that fund, I just have very much prioritized speaking with my legacy neighbors and talking to neighbors. And I think we all live in a neighborhood somewhere in Asheville, and we probably have some legacy neighbors, and I would say particularly Black neighbors, and just listening to them. I think the dominant narrative really, you know, drowns out some of those voices. And so making an effort to listen to your legacy neighbors, I think, is always a good thing. I appreciate the calls to action that the Racial Justice Coalition puts out. Signing up for their email list is a good way to be in the loop about things. I know and respect a lot of people on the Reparations Commission. And so I think following the Reparations Commission and supporting those, I'm just like amazed by people who've experienced so much harm in this community being willing to participate in this process. The Asheville Buncombe Community Land Trust, who the Montford and Stumptown Fund is part of, you can become a member of the land trust for just $25 a year and be in the loop with their work. On my website, which is amyworthen.com, I have a page called Community that's got some good links. And then I also have a page called Inspirations, which are folks not necessarily in Asheville that I learn from. So those are a few ideas.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah. Thank you for suggesting it. I'm going to give you the credit for that. But I'm just so delighted that you did, and so grateful for the conversation today.
That does it for this week's Asheville FM News Hour. I'm News Director Patricia Furnish. Special thanks to Michelle Sheeve, Emily Davis, KP Whaley, Mark West, and Dr. Dick Needleman. Coming up next, Run That Back.